Disc 3.
In the first place, said the rector, looking rather grave, it would be nonsensical to expect that I could convince Brooke and make him act accordingly. Brooke is a very good fellow, but pulpy. He will run into any mould, but he won't keep shape. He might keep shape long enough to defer the marriage, said Sir James. But, my dear Chetham, why should I use my influence to Casaubon's disadvantage unless I were much surer than I am that I should be acting for the advantage of Miss Brooke? I know no harm of Casaubon. I don't care about his Xisuthrus and Fee-Fo-Fum and the rest. But then he doesn't care about my fishing tackle. As to the line he took on the Catholic question, that was unexpected. But he has always been civil to me, and I don't see why I should spoil his sport. For anything I can tell, Miss Brooke may be happier with him than she would be with any other man.
Humphrey, I have no patience with you. You know you would rather dine under the hedge than with Casaubon alone. You have nothing to say to each other.
What has that to do with Miss Brooke's marrying him? She does not do it for my amusement. He has got no good red blood in his body, said Sir James.
No. Somebody put a drop under a magnifying glass, and it was all semicolons and parentheses, said Mrs. Cadwallader.
Why does he not bring out his book instead of marrying? Said Sir James, with a disgust which he held warranted by the sound feeling of an English layman.
Oh, he dreams footnotes, and they run away with all his brains. They say when he was a little boy, he made an abstract of Hop o' My Thumb, and he has been making abstracts ever since.
Ugh!
And that is the man Humphrey goes on saying that a woman may be happy with.
Well, he is what Miss Brooke likes, said the rector. I don't profess to understand every young lady's taste.
But if she were your own daughter, said Sir James.
That would be a different affair. She is not my daughter, and I don't feel called upon to interfere. Casaubon is as good as most of us. He is a scholarly clergyman and creditable to the cloth. Some radical fellow speechifying at Middlemarch said Casaubon was the learned straw-chopping incumbent and Freke was the brick-and-mortar incumbent and I was the angling incumbent. And upon my word, I don't see that one is worse or better than the other. The rector ended with his silent laugh. He always saw the joke of any satire against himself. His conscience was large and easy, like the rest of him. It did only what it could do without any trouble. Clearly, there would be no interference with Miss Brooke's marriage through Mr. Cadwallader, and Sir James felt with some sadness that she was to have perfect liberty of misjudgment. It was a sign of his good disposition that he did not slacken at all in his intention of carrying out Dorothea's design of the cottages. Doubtless, this persistence was the best course for his own dignity. But pride only helps us to be generous. It never makes us so. Any more than vanity makes us witty. She was now enough aware of Sir James's position with regard to her to appreciate the rectitude of his perseverance in a landlord's duty to which she had at first been urged by a lover's complaisance, and her pleasure in it was great enough to count for something, even in her present happiness. Perhaps she gave to Sir James Chetham's cottages all the interest she could spare from Mr. Casaubon, or rather, from the symphony of hopeful dreams, admiring trust, and passionate self-devotion which that learned gentleman had set playing in her soul. Hence it happened that in the good baronet's succeeding visits, while he was beginning to pay small attentions to Celia, he found himself talking with more and more pleasure to Dorothea. She was perfectly unconstrained and without irritation towards him now, and he was gradually discovering the delight there is in frank kindness and companionship between a man and a woman who have no passion to hide or confess. Chapter 9. Mr. Casaubon's behaviour about settlements was highly satisfactory to Mr. Brooke, and the preliminaries of marriage rolled smoothly along, shortening the weeks of courtship. The betrothed bride must see her future home and dictate any changes that she would like to have made there. A woman dictates before marriage in order that she may have an appetite for submission afterwards. And certainly, the mistakes that we male and female mortals make when we have our own way might fairly raise some wonder that we are so fond of it. On a grey but dry November morning, Dorothea drove to Lowick in company with her uncle and Celia. Mr. Casaubon's home was the manor house. Close by, visible from some parts of the garden, was the little church, with the old parsonage opposite. In the beginning of his career, Mr. Casaubon had only held the living, but the death of his brother had put him in possession of the manor also. It had a small park, with a fine old oak here and there, and an avenue of limes towards the southwest front, with a sunk fence between park and pleasure ground, so that from the drawing-room windows the glance swept uninterruptedly along a slope of greensward till the limes ended in a level of corn and pastures, which often seemed to melt into a lake under the setting sun. This was the happy side of the house, for the south and east looked rather melancholy even under the brightest morning. The grounds here were more confined, the flower-beds showed no very careful tendance, and large clumps of trees, chiefly of sombre yews, had risen high not 10 yards from the windows. The building, of greenish stone, was in the old English style, not ugly, but small-windowed and melancholy-looking. The sort of house that must have children, many flowers, open windows, and little vistas of bright things to make it seem a joyous home. In this latter end of autumn, with a sparse remnant of yellow leaves falling slowly athwart the dark evergreens, in a stillness without sunshine, the house too had an air of autumnal decline, and Mr. Casaubon, when he presented himself, had no bloom that could be thrown into relief by that background. "Oh, dear," Celia said to herself, "I am sure Freshitt Hall would have been pleasanter than this." She thought of the white freestone, the pillared portico, and the terrace full of flowers, Sir James smiling above them like a prince issuing from his enchantment in a rosebush with a handkerchief swiftly metamorphosed from the most delicately odorous petals. Sir James, who talked so agreeably, always about things which had common sense in them and not about learning. Celia had those light, young, feminine tastes which grave and weather-worn gentlemen sometimes prefer in a wife, but happily Mr. Casaubon's bias had been different, for he would have had no chance with Celia. Dorothea, on the contrary, found the house and grounds all that she could wish. The dark bookshelves in the long library, the carpets and curtains with colours subdued by time, the curious old maps and bird's-eye views on the walls of the corridor, with here and there an old vase below, had no oppression for her, and seemed more cheerful than the casts and pictures at the Grange, which her uncle had long ago brought home from his travels, they being probably among the ideas he had taken in at one time. To poor Dorothea, these severe classical nudities and smirking Renaissance correggiosities were painfully inexplicable, staring into the midst of her puritanic conceptions. She had never been taught how she could bring them into any sort of relevance with her life. But the owners of Lowick apparently had not been travellers, and Mr. Casaubon's studies of the past were not carried on by means of such aids. Dorothea walked about the house with delightful emotion. Everything seemed hallowed to her. This was to be the home of her wifehood, and she looked up with eyes full of confidence to Mr. Casaubon when he drew her attention specially to some actual arrangement and asked her if she would like an alteration. All appeals to her taste she met gratefully but saw nothing to alter. His efforts at exact courtesy and formal tenderness had no defect for her. She filled up all blanks with unmanifested perfections, interpreting him as she interpreted the works of Providence, and accounting for seeming discords by her own deafness to the higher harmonies. And there are many blanks left in the weeks of courtship, which a loving faith fills with happy assurance. "Now, my dear Dorothea, I wish you to favour me by pointing out which room you would like to have as your boudoir," said Mr. Casaubon, showing that his views of the womanly nature were sufficiently large to include that requirement. "It is very kind of you to think of that," said Dorothea, "but I assure you I would rather have all those matters decided for me. I shall be much happier to take everything as it is, just as you have been used to have it, or as you will yourself choose it to be. I have no motive for wishing anything else." "Oh, Dodo," said Celia, "will you not have the bow-windowed room upstairs?" Mr. Casaubon led the way thither. The bow-window looked down the avenue of limes. The furniture was all of a faded blue, and there were miniatures of ladies and gentlemen with powdered hair hanging in a group. A piece of tapestry over a door also showed a blue-green world with a pale stag in it. The chairs and tables were thin-legged and easy to upset. It was a room where one might fancy the ghost of a tight-laced lady revisiting the scene of her embroidery. A light bookcase contained duodecimo volumes of polite literature in calf, completing the furniture. "Yes," said Mr. Brooke, "this would be a pretty room, with some new hangings, sofas and that sort of thing. A little bare now." "No, uncle," said Dorothea eagerly. "Pray do not speak of altering anything. There are so many other things in the world that want altering. I like to take these things as they are. And you like them as they are, don't you?" she added, looking at Mr. Casaubon. "Perhaps this was your mother's room when she was young." "It was," he said with his slow bend of the head. "This is your mother," said Dorothea, who had turned to examine the group of miniatures. "It is like the tiny one you brought me, only I should think a better portrait. And this one opposite, who is this?" "Her elder sister. They were, like you and your sister, the only two children of their parents, who hang above them, you see."
"The sister is pretty," said Celia, implying that she thought less favourably of Mr. Casaubon's mother. It was a new opening to Celia's imagination that he came of a family who had all been young in their time, the ladies wearing necklaces. "It is a peculiar face," said Dorothea, looking closely. "Those deep grey eyes, rather near together, and the delicate, irregular nose with a sort of ripple in it, and all the powdered curls hanging backward. Altogether it seems to me peculiar rather than pretty. There is not even a family likeness between her and your mother."
"No, and they were not alike in their lot."
"You did not mention her to me," said Dorothea.
"My aunt made an unfortunate marriage. I never saw her."
Dorothea wondered a little, but felt that it would be indelicate just then to ask for any information which Mr. Casaubon did not proffer, and she turned to the window to admire the view. The sun had lately pierced the grey, and the avenue of limes cast shadows.
"Shall we not walk in the garden now?" said Dorothea. "And you would like to see the church, you know," said Mr. Brooke. "It is a droll little church. And the village, it all lies in a nutshell. By the way, it will suit you, Dorothea, for the cottages are like a row of almshouses, little gardens, gillyflowers, that sort of thing."
"Yes, please," said Dorothea, looking at Mr. Casaubon. "I should like to see all that."
She had got nothing from him more graphic about the Lowick cottages than that they were not bad.
They were soon on a gravel walk, which led chiefly between grassy borders and clumps of trees, this being the nearest way to the church, Mr. Casaubon said. At the little gate leading into the churchyard there was a pause, while Mr. Casaubon went to the parsonage close by to fetch a key. Celia, who had been hanging a little in the rear, came up presently, when she saw that Mr. Casaubon was gone away, and said in her easy staccato, which always seemed to contradict the suspicion of any malicious intent,
"Do you know, Dorothea, I saw someone quite young coming up one of the walks."
"Is that astonishing, Celia?"
"There may be a young gardener, you know. Why not?" said Mr. Brooke. "I told Casaubon he should change his gardener."
"No, not a gardener," said Celia. "A gentleman with a sketchbook. He had light brown curls. I only saw his back, but he was quite young."
"The curate's son, perhaps,"
said Mr. Brooke. "Ah, there is Casaubon again, and Tucker with him. He is going to introduce Tucker. You don't know Tucker yet."
Mr. Tucker was the middle-aged curate, one of the inferior clergy who are usually not wanting in sons. But after the introduction the conversation did not lead to any question about his family, and the startling apparition of youthfulness was forgotten by everyone but Celia. She inwardly declined to believe that the light brown curls and slim figure could have any relationship to Mr. Tucker, who was just as old and musty-looking as she would have expected Mr. Casaubon's curate to be. Doubtless an excellent man who would go to heaven, for Celia wished not to be unprincipled, but the corners of his mouth were so unpleasant. Celia thought with some dismalness of the time she should have to spend as bridesmaid at Lowick, where the curate had probably no pretty little children whom she could like, irrespective of principle. Mr. Tucker was invaluable in their walk, and perhaps Mr. Casaubon had not been without foresight on this head, the curate being able to answer all Dorothea's questions about the villagers and the other parishioners. Everybody, he assured her, was well off in Lowick. Not a cottager in those double cottages at a low rent, but kept a pig, and the strips of garden at the back were well tended. The small boys wore excellent corduroy. The girls went out as tidy servants or did a little straw plaiting at home. No looms here, no dissent. And though the public disposition was rather towards laying by money than towards spirituality, there was not much vice. The speckled fowls were so numerous that Mr. Brooke observed, "Your farmers leave some barley for the women to glean, I see." The poor folks here might have a fowl in their pot, as the good French king used to wish for all his people. The French eat a good many fowls, skinny fowls, you know. "I think it was a very cheap wish of his," said Dorothea indignantly. "Are kings such monsters that a wish like that must be reckoned a royal virtue?"
"And if he wished them a skinny fowl," said Celia, "that would not be nice. But perhaps he wished them to have fat fowls."
"Yes, but the word has dropped out of the text, or perhaps was suborditum, that is, present in the king's mind, but not uttered," said Mr. Casaubon, smiling, and bending his head towards Celia, who immediately dropped backward a little, because she could not bear Mr. Casaubon to blink at her.
Dorothea sank into silence on the way back to the house. She felt some disappointment, of which she was yet ashamed, that there was nothing for her to do in Lowick. And in the next few minutes her mind had glanced over the possibility, which she would have preferred, of finding that her home would be in a parish which had a larger share of the world's misery, so that she might have had more active duties in it. Then, recurring to the future actually before her, she made a picture of more complete devotion to Mr. Casaubon's aims, in which she would await new duties. Many such might reveal themselves to the higher knowledge gained by her in that companionship. Mr. Tucker soon left them, having some clerical work which would not allow him to lunch at the hall. And as they were re-entering the garden through the little gate, Mr. Casaubon said, "You seem a little sad, Dorothea. I trust you are pleased with what you have seen."
"I am feeling something which is perhaps foolish and wrong," answered Dorothea with her usual openness, "almost wishing that the people wanted more to be done for them here. I have known so few ways of making my life good for anything. Of course my notions of usefulness must be narrow. I must learn new ways of helping people."
"Doubtless," said Mr. Casaubon, "each position has its corresponding duties. Yours, I trust, as the mistress of Lowick, will not leave any yearning unfulfilled."
"Indeed I believe that," said Dorothea earnestly. "Do not suppose that I am sad."
"That is well. But if you are not tired, we will take another way to the house than that by which we came." Dorothea was not at all tired, and a little circuit was made towards a fine yew tree, the chief hereditary glory of the grounds on this side of the house. As they approached it, a figure, conspicuous on a dark background of evergreens, was seated on a bench, sketching the old tree. Mr. Brooke, who was walking in front with Celia, turned his head and said, "Who is that youngster, Casaubon?" They had come very near when Mr. Casaubon answered, "That is a young relative of mine, a second cousin,
"The grandson, in fact," he added, looking at Dorothea, "of the lady whose portrait you have been noticing, my Aunt Julia." The younger man had laid down his sketchbook and risen. His bushy light brown curls, as well as his youthfulness, identified him at once with Celia's apparition. "Dorothea, let me introduce you to my cousin, Mr. Ladislaw. Will, this is Miss Brooke." The cousin was so close now that when he lifted his hat, Dorothea could see a pair of grey eyes rather near together, a delicate irregular nose with a little ripple in it, and hair falling backward. But there was a mouth and chin of a more prominent, threatening aspect than belonged to the type of the grandmother's miniature. Young Ladislaw did not feel it necessary to smile as if he were charmed with this introduction to his future second cousin and her relatives, but wore rather a pouting air of discontent. "You are an artist, I see," said Mr. Brooke, taking up the sketchbook and turning it over in his unceremonious fashion. "No, I only sketch a little. There is nothing fit to be seen there," said young Ladislaw, colouring, perhaps with temper rather than modesty. "Oh, come, this is a nice bit now. I did a little in this way myself at one time, you know. Look here now, this is what I call a nice thing, done with what we used to call brio." Mr. Brooke held out towards the two girls a large coloured sketch of stony ground and trees with a pool. "I am no judge of these things," said Dorothea, not coldly, but with an eager deprecation of the appeal to her. "You know, Uncle, I never see the beauty of those pictures which you say are so much praised. They are a language I do not understand. I suppose there is some relation between pictures and nature which I am too ignorant to feel, just as you see what a Greek sentence stands for, which means nothing to me." Dorothea looked up at Mr. Casaubon, who bowed his head towards her, while Mr. Brooke said, smiling nonchalantly, "Bless me now, how different people are! But you had a bad style of teaching, you know, else this is just the thing for girls, sketching, fine art, and so on. But you took to drawing plans. You don't understand morbidezza and that kind of thing. You will come to my house, I hope, and I will show you what I did in this way," he continued, turning to young Ladislaw, who had to be recalled from his preoccupation in observing Dorothea. Ladislaw had made up his mind that she must be an unpleasant girl, since she was going to marry Casaubon, and what she said of her stupidity about pictures would have confirmed that opinion, even if he had believed her. As it was, he took her words for a covert judgment, and was certain that she thought his sketch detestable. There was too much cleverness in her apology. She was laughing both at her uncle and himself. But what a voice! It was like the voice of a soul that had once lived in an Aeolian harp. This must be one of nature's inconsistencies. There could be no sort of passion in a girl who would marry Casaubon. But he turned from her, and bowed his thanks for Mr. Brooke's invitation. "We will turn over my Italian engravings together," continued that good-natured man. "I have no end of those things that I have laid by for years. One gets rusty in this part of the country, you know. Not you, Casaubon. You stick to your studies. But my best ideas get undermost, out of use, you know. You clever young men must guard against indolence. I was too indolent, you know, else I might have been anywhere at one time." "That is a seasonable admonition," said Mr. Casaubon. "But now we will pass on to the house, lest the young ladies should be tired of standing." When their backs were turned, young Ladislaw sat down to go on with his sketching. And as he did so, his face broke into an expression of amusement, which increased as he went on drawing, till at last he threw back his head and laughed aloud. Partly it was the reception of his own artistic production that tickled him, partly the notion of his grave cousin as the lover of that girl, and partly Mr. Brooke's definition of the place he might have held but for the impediment of indolence. Mr. Will Ladislaw's sense of the ludicrous lit up his features very agreeably. It was the pure enjoyment of comicality, and had no mixture of sneering and self-exaltation. "What is your nephew going to do with himself, Casaubon?" said Mr. Brooke as they went on. "My cousin, you mean? Not my nephew." "Yes, yes, cousin, but in the way of a career, you know." "The answer to that question is painfully doubtful. On leaving Rugby, he declined to go to an English university, where I would gladly have placed him, and chose what I must consider the anomalous course of studying at Heidelberg. And now he wants to go abroad again, without any special object save the vague purpose of what he calls culture, preparation for he knows not what. He declines to choose a profession.
He has no means but what you furnish, I suppose.
I have always given him and his friends reason to understand that I would furnish in moderation what was necessary for providing him with a scholarly education and launching him respectably. I am therefore bound to fulfil the expectations so raised, said Mr. Casaubon, putting his conduct in the light of mere rectitude, a trait of delicacy which Dorothea noticed with admiration.
He has a thirst for travelling. Perhaps he may turn out a Bruce or a Mungo Park, said Mr. Brooke. I had a notion of that myself at one time.
No, he has no bent towards exploration or the enlargement of our geognosis. That would be a special purpose which I could recognise with some approbation, though without felicitating him on a career which so often ends in premature and violent death. But so far is he from having any desire for a more accurate knowledge of the earth's surface, that he said he should prefer not to know the sources of the Nile, and that there should be some unknown regions preserved as hunting grounds for the poetic imagination.
"Well, there is something in that, you know," said Mr. Brooke, who had certainly an impartial mind.
"It is, I fear, nothing more than a part of his general inaccuracy and indisposition to thoroughness of all kinds, which would be a bad augury for him in any profession, civil or sacred, even were he so far submissive to ordinary rule as to choose one.
Perhaps he has conscientious scruples founded on his own unfitness," said Dorothea, who was interesting herself in finding a favourable explanation. "Because the law and medicine should be very serious professions to undertake, should they not? People's lives and fortunes depend on them."
"Doubtless. But I fear that my young relative, Will Ladislaw, is chiefly determined in his aversion to these callings by a dislike to steady application, and to that kind of acquirement which is needful instrumentally, but is not charming or immediately inviting to self-indulgent taste. I have insisted to him on what Aristotle has stated with admirable brevity, that for the achievement of any work regarded as an end, there must be a prior exercise of many energies, or acquired facilities of a secondary order demanding patience. I have pointed to my own manuscript volumes, which represent the toil of years preparatory to a work not yet accomplished. But in vain. To careful reasoning of this kind, he replies by calling himself Pegasus, and every form of prescribed work, harness." Celia laughed. She was surprised to find that Mr. Casaubon could say something quite amusing.
"Well, you know, he may turn out a Byron, a Chatterton, a Churchill, that sort of thing. There's no telling," said Mr. Brooke. "Shall you let him go to Italy or wherever else he wants to go?"
"Yes. I have agreed to furnish him with moderate supplies for a year or so. He asks no more. I shall let him be tried by the test of freedom."
"That is very kind of you," said Dorothea, looking up at Mr. Casaubon with delight. "It is noble.
After all, people may really have in them some vocation which is not quite plain to themselves, may they not?
They may seem idle and weak because they are growing. We should be very patient with each other, I think."
"I suppose it is being engaged to be married that has made you think patience good," said Celia, as soon as she and Dorothea were alone together, taking off their wrappings.
"You mean that I am very impatient, Celia?"
"Yes, when people don't do and say just what you like."
Celia had become less afraid of saying things to Dorothea since this engagement. Cleverness seemed to her more pitiable than ever.
Chapter 10. Young Ladislaw did not pay that visit to which Mr. Brooke had invited him,
and only 6 days afterwards Mr. Casaubon mentioned that his young relative had started for the continent, seeming by this cold vagueness to waive inquiry. Indeed, Will had declined to fix on any more precise destination than the entire area of Europe. Genius, he held, is necessarily intolerant of fetters. On the one hand, it must have the utmost play for its spontaneity. On the other, it may confidently await those messages from the universe which summon it to its peculiar work, only placing itself in an attitude of receptivity towards all sublime chances. The attitudes of receptivity are various, and Will had sincerely tried many of them. He was not excessively fond of wine, but he had several times taken too much, simply as an experiment in that form of ecstasy. He had fasted till he was faint, and then supped on lobster. He had made himself ill with doses of opium. Nothing greatly original had resulted from these measures, and the effects of the opium had convinced him that there was an entire dissimilarity between his constitution and De Quincey's. The superadded circumstance which would evolve the genius had not yet come. The universe had not yet beckoned. Even Caesar's fortune at one time was but a grand presentiment. We know what a masquerade all development is, and what effective shapes may be disguised in helpless embryos. In fact, the world is full of hopeful analogies and handsome dubious eggs called possibilities. Will saw clearly enough the pitiable instances of long incubation producing no chick, and but for gratitude would have laughed at Casaubon, whose plodding application, rows of notebooks and small taper of learned theory exploring the tossed ruins of the world, seemed to enforce a moral entirely encouraging to Will's generous reliance on the intentions of the universe with regard to himself. He held that reliance to be a mark of genius, and certainly it is no mark to the contrary, genius consisting neither in self-conceit nor in humility, but in a power to make or do not anything in general, but something in particular. Let him start for the continent, then, without our pronouncing on his future. Among all forms of mistake, prophecy is the most gratuitous. But at present, this caution against a too hasty judgment interests me more in relation to Mr. Casaubon than to his young cousin. If, to Dorothea, Mr. Casaubon had been the mere occasion which had set alight the fine, inflammable material of her youthful illusions, does it follow that he was fairly represented in the minds of those less impassioned personages who have hitherto delivered their judgments concerning him? I protest against any absolute conclusion, any prejudice derived from Mrs. Cadwallader's contempt for a neighbouring clergyman's alleged greatness of soul, of Sir James Chettam's poor opinion of his rival's legs, from Mr. Brooke's failure to elicit a companion's ideas, or from Celia's criticism of a middle-aged scholar's personal appearance. I am not sure that the greatest man of his age, if ever that solitary superlative existed, could escape these unfavourable reflections of himself in various small mirrors, and even Milton, looking for his portrait in a spoon, must submit to have the facial angle of a bumpkin. Moreover, if Mr. Casaubon, speaking for himself, has rather chilling rhetoric, it is not therefore certain that there is no good work or fine feeling in him. Did not an immortal physicist and interpreter of hieroglyphs write detestable verses? Has the theory of the solar system been advanced by graceful manners and conversational tact? Suppose we turn from outside estimates of a man to wonder with keener interest what is the report of his own consciousness about his doings or capacity, with what hindrances he is carrying on his daily labours, what fading of hopes, or what deeper fixity of self-delusion the years are marking off within him, and with what spirit he wrestles against universal pressure, which will one day be too heavy for him, and bring his heart to its final pause. Doubtless his lot is important in his own eyes, and the chief reason that we think he asks too large a place in our consideration must be our want of room for him, since we refer him to the divine regard with perfect confidence. Nay, it is even held sublime for our neighbour to expect the utmost there, however little he may have got from us. Mr. Casaubon, too, was the centre of his own world. If he was liable to think that others were providentially made for him, and especially to consider them in the light of their fitness for the author of A Key to All Mythologies. This trait is not quite alien to us, and, like the other mendicant hopes of mortals, claims some of our pity. Certainly this affair of his marriage with Miss Brooke touched him more nearly than it did any one of the persons who have hitherto shown their disapproval of it, and in the present stage of things I feel more tenderly towards his experience of success than towards the disappointment of the amiable Sir James. For in truth, as the day fixed for his marriage came nearer, Mr. Casaubon did not find his spirits rising, nor did the contemplation of that matrimonial garden scene, whereas all experience showed the path was to be bordered with flowers, prove persistently more enchanting to him than the accustomed vaults where he walked taper in hand. He did not confess to himself, still less could he have breathed to another, his surprise that though he had won a lovely and noble-hearted girl, he had not won Delight, which he had also regarded as an object to be found by search. It is true that he knew all the classical passages implying the contrary, but knowing classical passages, we find, is a mode of motion which explains why they leave so little extra force for their personal application. Poor Mr. Casaubon had imagined that his long, studious bachelorhood had stored up for him a compound interest of enjoyment, and that large drafts on his affections would not fail to be honoured. For we all of us, grave or light, get our thoughts entangled in metaphors, and act fatally on the strength of them. And now he was in danger of being saddened by the very conviction that his circumstances were unusually happy. There was nothing external by which he could account for a certain blankness of sensibility which came over him, just when his expectant gladness should have been most lively, just when he exchanged the accustomed dullness of his Lowick library for his visits to the Grange. Here was a weary experience, in which he was as utterly condemned to loneliness as in the despair which sometimes threatened him while toiling in the morass of authorship, without seeming nearer to the goal. And his was that worst loneliness which would shrink from sympathy. He could not but wish that Dorothea should think him not less happy than the world would expect her successful suitor to be. And in relation to his authorship, he leaned on her young trust and veneration. He liked to draw forth her fresh interest in listening as a means of encouragement to himself. In talking to her, he presented all his performance and intention with the reflected confidence of the pedagogue, and rid himself for the time of that chilling ideal audience which crowded his laborious uncreative hours with the vaporous pressure of Tartarian shades. For to Dorothea, after that toy-box history of the world adapted to young ladies which had made the chief part of her education, Mr. Casaubon's talk about his great book was full of new vistas. And this sense of revelation, this surprise of a nearer introduction to Stoics and Alexandrians as people who had ideas not totally unlike her own, kept in abeyance for the time her usual eagerness for a binding theory which could bring her own life and doctrine into strict connection with that amazing past, and give the remotest sources of knowledge some bearing on her actions. That more complete teaching would come. Mr. Casaubon would tell her all that. She was looking forward to higher initiation in ideas, as she was looking forward to marriage, and blending her dim conceptions of both. It would be a great mistake to suppose that Dorothea would have cared about any share in Mr. Casaubon's learning as mere accomplishment. For though opinion in the neighbourhood of Freshett and Tipton had pronounced her clever, that epithet would not have described her to circles in whose more precise vocabulary cleverness implies mere aptitude for knowing and doing apart from character. All her eagerness for acquirement lay within that full current of sympathetic motive in which her ideas and impulses were habitually swept along. She did not want to deck herself with knowledge, to wear it loose from the nerves and blood that fed her action. And if she had written a book, she must have done it as St. Teresa did, under the command of an authority that constrained her conscience. But something she yearned for, by which her life might be filled with action at once rational and ardent. and since the time was gone by for guiding visions and spiritual directors. Since prayer heightened yearning but not instruction, what lamp was there but knowledge? Surely learned men kept the only oil, and who more learned than Mr. Casaubon? Thus in these brief weeks Dorothea's joyous, grateful expectation was unbroken, and however her lover might occasionally be conscious of flatness, he could never refer it to any slackening of her affectionate interest. The season was mild enough to encourage the project of extending the wedding journey as far as Rome, and Mr. Casaubon was anxious for this because he wished to inspect some manuscripts in the Vatican. "I still regret that your sister is not to accompany us," he said one morning, some time after it had been ascertained that Celia objected to go and that Dorothea did not wish for her companionship. "You will have many lonely hours, Dorothea, for I shall be constrained to make the utmost use of my time during our stay in Rome, and I should feel more at liberty if you had a companion." The words, "I should feel more at liberty," grated on Dorothea. For the first time in speaking to Mr. Casaubon, she coloured from annoyance. "You must have misunderstood me very much," she said, "if you think I should not enter into the value of your time. If you think that I should not willingly give up whatever interfered with your using it to the best purpose." "That is very amiable in you, my dear Dorothea," said Mr. Casaubon, not in the least noticing that she was hurt. "But if you had a lady as your companion, I could put you both under the care of a cicerone, and we could thus achieve two purposes in the same space of time." "I beg you will not refer to this again," said Dorothea rather haughtily. But immediately she feared that she was wrong, and turning toward him she laid her hand on his, adding in a different tone, "Pray do not be anxious about me. I shall have so much to think of when I am alone, and Tantripp will be a sufficient companion just to take care of me. I could not bear to have Celia. She would be miserable." It was time to dress. There was to be a dinner party that day, the last of the parties which were held at the Grange as proper preliminaries to the wedding, and Dorothea was glad of a reason for moving away at once on the sound of the bell, as if she needed more than her usual amount of preparation. She was ashamed of being irritated from some cause she could not define, even to herself, for though she had no intention to be untruthful, her reply had not touched the real hurt within her. Mr. Casaubon's words had been quite reasonable, yet they had brought a vague, instantaneous sense of aloofness on his part. "Surely I am in a strangely selfish, weak state of mind," she said to herself. "How can I have a husband who is so much above me without knowing that he needs me less than I need him?" Having convinced herself that Mr. Casaubon was altogether right, she recovered her equanimity, and was an agreeable image of serene dignity when she came into the drawing-room in her silver-grey dress, the simple lines of her dark brown hair parted over her brow and coiled massively behind, in keeping with the entire absence from her manner and expression of all search after mere effect. Sometimes when Dorothea was in company, there seemed to be as complete an air of repose about her as if she had been a picture of Santa Barbara looking out from her tower into the clear air. But these intervals of quietude made the energy of her speech and emotion the more remarked when some outward appeal had touched her. She was naturally the subject of many observations this evening, for the dinner party was large, and rather more miscellaneous as to the male portion than any which had been held at the Grange since Mr. Brooke's nieces had resided with him, so that the talking was done in duos and trios, more or less inharmonious. There was the newly elected mayor of Middlemarch, who happened to be a manufacturer, the philanthropic banker, his brother-in-law, who predominated so much in the town that some called him a Methodist, others a hypocrite, according to the resources of their vocabulary. And there were various professional men. In fact, Mrs. Cadwallader said that Brooke was beginning to treat the Middlemarchers, and that she preferred the farmers at the tithe dinner, who drank her health unpretentiously and were not ashamed of their grandfather's furniture. For in that part of the country, before reform had done its notable part in developing the political consciousness, there was a clearer distinction of ranks and a dimmer distinction of parties, so that Mr. Brooke's miscellaneous invitations seemed to belong to that general laxity which came from his inordinate travel and habit of taking too much in the form of ideas. Already, as Miss Brooke passed out of the dining room, opportunity was found for some interjectional asides.
"A fine woman, Miss Brooke, an uncommonly fine woman, by God," said Mr. Standish, the old lawyer, who had been so long concerned with the landed gentry that he had become landed himself, and used that oath in a deep-mouthed manner as a sort of armorial bearings, stamping the speech of a man who held a good position. Mr. Bulstrode, the banker, seemed to be addressed, but that gentleman disliked coarseness and profanity and merely bowed. The remark was taken up by Mr. Chicherley, a middle-aged bachelor and coursing celebrity who had a complexion something like an Easter egg, a few hairs carefully arranged, and a carriage implying the consciousness of a distinguished appearance.
"Yes, but not my style of woman. I like a woman who lays herself out a little more to please us. There should be a little filigree about a woman, something of the coquette. A man likes a sort of challenge. The more of a dead set she makes at you, the better."
"There's some truth in that," said Mr. Standish, disposed to be genial. "And by God, it's usually the way with them. I suppose it answers some wise ends. Providence made them so, eh, Bulstrode?"
"I should be disposed to refer coquetry to another source," said Mr. Bulstrode. "I should rather refer it to the devil."
"Aye, to be sure, there should be a little devil in a woman," said Mr. Chicherley, whose study of the fair sex seemed to have been detrimental to his theology. "And I like them blonde, with a certain gait and a swan neck. Between ourselves, the mayor's daughter is more to my taste than Miss Brooke or Miss Celia either. If I were a marrying man, I should choose Miss Vincey before either of them."
"Well, make up, make up," said Mr. Standish jocosely. "You see, the middle-aged fellows carry the day."
Mr. Chicherley shook his head with much meaning. He was not going to incur the certainty of being accepted by the woman he would choose. The Miss Vincey, who had the honour of being Mr. Chicherley's ideal, was of course not present, for Mr. Brooke, always objecting to go too far, would not have chosen that his nieces should meet the daughter of a Middlemarch manufacturer, unless it were on a public occasion. The feminine part of the company included none whom Lady Chatham or Mrs. Cadwallader could object to, for Mrs. Renfrew, the Colonel's widow, was not only unexceptionable in point of breeding, but also interesting on the ground of her complaint, which puzzled the doctors and seemed clearly a case wherein the fullness of professional knowledge might need the supplement of quackery. Lady Chatham, who attributed her own remarkable health to homemade bitters united with constant medical attendance, entered with much exercise of the imagination into Mrs. Renfrew's account of symptoms and into the amazing futility in her case of all strengthening medicines.
"Where can all the strength of those medicines go, my dear?" said the mild but stately dowager, turning to Mrs. Cadwallader reflectively when Mrs. Renfrew's attention was called away.
"It strengthens the disease," said the rector's wife, much too well born not to be an amateur in medicine. "Everything depends on the constitution. Some people make fat, some blood, and some bile. That's my view of the matter. And whatever they take is a sort of grist to the mill."
"Then she ought to take medicines that would reduce the disease, you know, if you are right, my dear. And I think what you say is reasonable."
"Certainly it is reasonable. You have two sorts of potatoes fed on the same soil. One of them grows more and more watery."
"Ah, like this poor Mrs. Renfrew. That is what I think. Dropsy. There is no swelling yet. It is inward. I should say she ought to take drying medicines, shouldn't you? Or a dry hot air bath. Many things might be tried of a drying nature."
"Let her try a certain person's pamphlets," said Mrs. Cadwallader in an undertone, seeing the gentleman enter. "He does not want drying."
"Who, my dear?" said Lady Chatham, a charming woman, not so quick as to nullify the pleasure of explanation. "The bridegroom, Casaubon.
He has certainly been drying up faster since the engagement.
The flame of passion, I suppose.
I should think he is far from having a good constitution, said Lady Chetham, with a still deeper undertone. And then his studies, so very dry, as you say. Really, by the side of Sir James, he looks like a death's head skinned over for the occasion. Mark my words, in a year from this time that girl will hate him. She looks up to him as an oracle now, and by she will be at the other extreme, all flightiness.
How very shocking. I fear she is headstrong. But tell me, you know all about him. Is there anything very bad? What is the truth?
The truth? He is as bad as the wrong physic, nasty to take and sure to disagree.
There could not be anything worse than that, said Lady Chetham,
with so vivid a conception of the physic that she seemed to have learned something exact about Mr. Casaubon's disadvantages. However, James will hear nothing about Miss Brooke. He says she is the mirror of women still.
That is a generous make-believe of his.
Depend upon it, he likes little Celia better, and she appreciates him. I hope you like my little Celia.
Certainly. She is fonder of geraniums, and seems more docile, though not so fine a figure. But we were talking of physic. Tell me about this new young surgeon, Mr. Lydgate. I am told he is wonderfully clever. He certainly looks it. A fine brow, indeed.
He is a gentleman. I heard him talking to Humphrey. He talks well.
Yes. Mr. Brooke says he is one of the Lydgates of Northumberland, really well connected. One does not expect it in a practitioner of that kind. For my own part, I like a medical man more on a footing with the servants. They are often all the cleverer. I assure you I found poor Hicks's judgment unfailing. I never knew him wrong. He was coarse and butcher-like, but he knew my constitution. It was a loss to me, his going off so suddenly.
Dear me, what a very animated conversation Miss Brooke seems to be having with this Mr. Lydgate.
She is talking cottages and hospitals with him, said Mrs. Cadwallader, whose ears and power of interpretation were quick. I believe he is a sort of philanthropist, so Brooke is sure to take him up.
James, said Lady Chetham when her son came near, bring Mr. Lydgate and introduce him to me. I want to test him.
The affable dowager declared herself delighted with this opportunity of making Mr. Lydgate's acquaintance, having heard of his success in treating fever on a new plan. Mr. Lydgate had the medical accomplishment of looking perfectly grave, whatever nonsense was talked to him, and his dark, steady eyes gave him impressiveness as a listener. He was as little as possible like the lamented Hicks, especially in a certain careless refinement about his toilette and utterance. Yet Lady Chetham gathered much confidence in him. He confirmed her view of her own constitution as being peculiar, by admitting that all constitutions might be called peculiar, and he did not deny that hers might be more peculiar than others. He did not approve of a too lowering system, including reckless cupping, nor, on the other hand, of incessant port wine and bark. He said, "I think so," with an air of so much deference accompanying the insight of agreement, that she formed the most cordial opinion of his talents.
"I am quite pleased with your protégé," she said to Mr. Brooke before going away.
"My protégé, dear me? Who is that?" said Mr. Brooke.
"This young Lydgate, the new doctor. He seems to me to understand his profession admirably."
"Oh, Lydgate! He is not my protégé, you know. Only I knew an uncle of his who sent me a letter about him. However, I think he is likely to be first-rate, has studied in Paris, knew Brousset, has ideas, you know, wants to raise the profession."
"Lydgate has lots of ideas, quite new, about ventilation and diet, that sort of thing," resumed Mr. Brooke,
after he had handed out Lady Chetham and had returned to be civil to a group of Middlemarchers. Hang it. Do you think that is quite sound? Upsetting the old treatment which has made Englishmen what they are? Said Mr. Standish.
Medical knowledge is at a low ebb among us, said Mr. Bulstrode, who spoke in a subdued tone and had rather a sickly air.
I, for my part, hail the advent of Mr. Lydgate. I hope to find good reason for confiding the new hospital to his management.
That is all very fine, replied Mr. Standish, who was not fond of Mr. Bulstrode. If you like him to try experiments on your hospital patients and kill a few people for charity, I have no objection. But I am not going to hand money out of my purse to have experiments tried on me. I like treatment that has been tested a little.
Well, you know, Standish, every dose you take is an experiment. An experiment, you know, said Mr. Brooke, nodding towards the lawyer.
Oh, if you talk in that sense, said Mr. Standish, with as much disgust at such non-legal quibbling as a man can well betray towards a valuable client.
I should be glad of any treatment that would cure me without reducing me to a skeleton like poor Granger, said Mr. Vincey, the mayor, a florid man who would have served for a study of flesh in striking contrast with the Franciscan tints of Mr. Bulstrode.
It is an uncommonly dangerous thing to be left without any padding against the shafts of disease, as somebody said, and I think it a very good expression myself.
Mr. Lydgate, of course, was out of hearing. He had quitted the party early, and would have thought it altogether tedious, but for the novelty of certain introductions, especially the introduction to Miss Brooke, whose youthful bloom, with her approaching marriage to that faded scholar, and her interest in matters socially useful, gave her the piquancy of an unusual combination. "She is a good creature, that fine girl, but a little too earnest," he thought. "It is troublesome to talk to such women. They are always wanting reasons, yet they are too ignorant to understand the merits of any question, and usually fall back on their moral sense to settle things after their own taste." Evidently Miss Brooke was not Mr. Lydgate's style of woman any more than Mr. Chichely's. Considered indeed in relation to the latter, whose mind was matured, she was altogether a mistake, and calculated to shock his trust in final causes, including the adaptation of fine young women to purple-faced bachelors. But Lydgate was less ripe, and might possibly have experience before him which would modify his opinion as to the most excellent things in woman. Miss Brooke, however, was not again seen by either of these gentlemen under her maiden name. Not long after that dinner party, she had become Mrs. Casaubon, and was on her way to Rome.
Chapter 11. Lydgate, in fact, was already conscious of being fascinated by a woman strikingly different from Miss Brooke. He did not in the least suppose that he had lost his balance and fallen in love, but he had said of that particular woman, "She is grace itself. She is perfectly lovely and accomplished. That is what a woman ought to be. She ought to produce the effect of exquisite music." Plain women, he regarded, as he did the other severe facts of life, to be faced with philosophy and investigated by science. But Rosamund Vincey seemed to have the true melodic charm. And when a man has seen the woman whom he would have chosen if he had intended to marry speedily, his remaining a bachelor will usually depend on her resolution rather than on his. Lydgate believed that he should not marry for several years. Not marry until he had trodden out a good, clear path for himself, away from the broad road which was quite ready-made. He had seen Miss Vincey above his horizon almost as long as it had taken Mr. Casaubon to become engaged and married. But this learned gentleman was possessed of a fortune. He had assembled his voluminous notes and had made that sort of reputation which precedes performance, often the larger part of a man's fame. He took a wife, as we have seen, to adorn the remaining quadrant of his course, and be a little moon that would cause hardly a calculable perturbation. But Lydgate was young, poor, ambitious. He had his half-century before him instead of behind him, and he had come to Middlemarch bent on doing many things that were not directly fitted to make his fortune, or even secure him a good income. To a man under such circumstances, taking a wife is something more than a question of adornment, however highly he may rate this. And Lydgate was disposed to give it the first place among wifely functions. To his taste, guided by a single conversation, here was the point on which Miss Brooke would be found wanting, notwithstanding her undeniable beauty. She did not look at things from the proper feminine angle. The society of such women was about as relaxing as going from your work to teach the second form, instead of reclining in a paradise with sweet laughs for bird notes and blue eyes for a heaven. Certainly nothing at present could seem much less important to Lydgate than the turn of Miss Brooke's mind, or to Miss Brooke than the qualities of the woman who had attracted this young surgeon. But anyone watching keenly the stealthy convergence of human lots sees a slow preparation of effects from one life on another, which tells like a calculated irony on the indifference or the frozen stare with which we look at our unintroduced neighbour. Destiny stands by sarcastic, with our dramatis personae folded in her hand. Old provincial society had its share of this subtle movement, had not only its striking downfalls, its brilliant young professional dandies who ended by living up an entry with a drab and six children for their establishment, but also those less marked vicissitudes which are constantly shifting the boundaries of social intercourse and begetting new consciousness of interdependence. Some slipped a little downward, some got higher footing. People denied aspirates, gained wealth, and fastidious gentlemen stood for boroughs. Some were caught in political currents, some in ecclesiastical, and perhaps found themselves surprisingly grouped in consequence. While a few personages or families that stood with rock firmness amid all this fluctuation were slowly presenting new aspects in spite of solidity, and altering with the double change of self and beholder. Municipal town and rural parish gradually made fresh threads of connection. Gradually, as the old stocking gave way to the savings bank, and the worship of the solar guinea became extinct, while squires and baronets and even lords, who had once lived blamelessly afar from the civic mind, gathered the faultiness of closer acquaintanceship. Settlers, too, came from distant counties, some with an alarming novelty of skill, others with an offensive advantage in cunning. In fact, much the same sort of movement and mixture went on in Old England as we find in older Herodotus, who also, in telling what had been, thought it well to take a woman's lot for his starting point. Though Io, as a maiden apparently beguiled by attractive merchandise, was the reverse of Miss Brooke, and in this respect perhaps bore more resemblance to Rosamund Vincy, who had excellent taste in costume, with that nymph-like figure and pure blondness which gave the largest range to choice in the flow and colour of drapery. But these things made only part of her charm. She was admitted to be the flower of Mrs. Lemon's school, the chief school in the county, where the teaching included all that was demanded in the accomplished female, even to extras such as the getting in and out of a carriage. Mrs. Lemon herself had always held up Miss Vincy as an example. No pupil, she said, exceeded that young lady for mental acquisition and propriety of speech, while her musical execution was quite exceptional. We cannot help the way in which people speak of us, and probably if Mrs. Lemon had undertaken to describe Juliet or Imogen, these heroines would not have seemed poetical. The first vision of Rosamond would have been enough, with most judges, to dispel any prejudice excited by Mrs. Lemon's praise. Lydgate could not be long in Middlemarch without having that agreeable vision, or even without making the acquaintance of the Vincy family. For though Mr. Peacock, whose practice he had paid something to enter on, had not been their doctor, Mrs. Vincy not liking the lowering system adopted by him, he had many patients among their connections and acquaintances. For who of any consequence in Middlemarch was not connected, or at least acquainted, with the Vincys? They were old manufacturers,
and had kept a good house for 3 generations, in which there had naturally been much intermarrying with neighbours more or less decidedly genteel. Mr. Vincey's sister had made a wealthy match in accepting Mr. Bulstrode, who, however, as a man not born in the town and altogether of dimly known origin, was considered to have done well in uniting himself with a real Middlemarch family. On the other hand, Mr. Vincey had descended a little, having taken an innkeeper's daughter. But on this side, too, there was a cheering sense of money, for Mrs. Vincey's sister had been second wife to rich old Mr. Featherstone, and had died childless years ago, so that her nephews and nieces might be supposed to touch the affections of the widower. And it happened that Mr. Bulstrode and Mr. Featherstone, 2 of Peacock's most important patients, had, from different causes, given an especially good reception to his successor, who had raised some partisanship as well as discussion. Mr. Wrench, medical attendant to the Vincey family, very early had grounds for thinking lightly of Lydgate's professional discretion, and there was no report about him which was not retailed at the Vincey's, where visitors were frequent. Mr. Vincey was more inclined to general good fellowship than to taking sides, but there was no need for him to be hasty in making any new man's acquaintance. Rosamond silently wished that her father would invite Mr. Lydgate. She was tired of the faces and figures she had always been used to, the various irregular profiles and gaits and turns of phrase distinguishing those Middlemarch young men whom she had known as boys. She had been at school with girls of higher position, whose brothers, she felt sure, it would have been possible for her to be more interested in than in these inevitable Middlemarch companions. But she would not have chosen to mention her wish to her father, and he, for his part, was in no hurry on the subject. An alderman about to be mayor must by and by enlarge his dinner parties, but at present there were plenty of guests at his well-spread table. That table often remained covered with the relics of the family breakfast, long after Mr. Vincey had gone with his second son to the warehouse, and when Miss Morgan was already far on in morning lessons with the younger girls in the schoolroom. It awaited the family laggard, who found any sort of inconvenience, to others, less disagreeable than getting up when he was called. This was the case one morning of the October in which we have lately seen Mr. Casaubon visiting the Grange. And though the room was a little overheated with the fire, which had sent the spaniel panting to a remote corner, Rosamond, for some reason, continued to sit at her embroidery longer than usual, now and then giving herself a little shake and laying her work on her knee to contemplate it with an air of hesitating weariness. Her mamma, who had returned from an excursion to the kitchen, sat on the other side of the small work-table with an air of more entire placidity. Until, the clock again giving notice that it was going to strike, she looked up from the lace-mending which was occupying her plump fingers and rang the bell. "Knock at Mr. Fred's door again, Pritchard, and tell him it has struck 10:30. This was said without any change in the radiant good humour of Mrs. Vincey's face, in which 45 years had delved neither angles nor parallels, and pushing back her pink cap-strings, she let her work rest on her lap, while she looked admiringly at her daughter. "Mamma," said Rosamond, "when Fred comes down, I wish you would not let him have red herrings. I cannot bear the smell of them all over the house at this hour of the morning."
"Oh, my dear, you are so hard on your brothers. It is the only fault I have to find with you. You are the sweetest temper in the world, but you are so tetchy with your brothers."
"Not tetchy, Mamma. You never hear me speak in an unladylike way."
"Well, but you want to deny them things."
"Brothers are so unpleasant."
"Oh, my dear, you must allow for young men. Be thankful if they have good hearts. A woman must learn to put up with little things. You will be married some day."
"Not to anyone who is like Fred."
"Don't decry your own brother, my dear. Few young men have less against them, although he couldn't take his degree. I'm sure I can't understand why, for he seems to me most clever.
and you know yourself he was thought equal to the best society at college. So particular as you are, my dear, I wonder you are not glad to have such a gentlemanly young man for a brother. You are always finding fault with Bob because he is not Fred.
Oh, no, Mamma, only because he is Bob.
Well, my dear, you will not find any Middlemarch young man who has not something against him.
But...
Here Rosamond's face broke into a smile, which suddenly revealed two dimples. She herself thought unfavourably of these dimples, and smiled little in general society.
But I shall not marry any Middlemarch young man.
So it seems, my love, for you have as good as refused the pick of them. And if there's better to be had, I'm sure there's no girl better deserves it.
Excuse me, Mamma. I wish you would not say the pick of them.
Why? What else are they?
I mean, Mamma, it is rather a vulgar expression.
Very likely, my dear. I never was a good speaker. What should I say?
The best of them.
Why, that seems just as plain and common. If I had had time to think, I should have said, the most superior young men. But with your education, you must know.
What must Rosie know, mother?
Said Mr. Fred, who had slid in unobserved through the half-open door while the ladies were bending over their work, and now, going up to the fire, stood with his back towards it, warming the soles of his slippers.
Whether it's right to say superior young men, said Mrs. Vincey, ringing the bell.
Oh, there are so many superior teas and sugars now. Superior is getting to be shopkeeper's slang.
Are you beginning to dislike slang, then? Said Rosamond, with mild gravity.
Only the wrong sort. All choice of words is slang. It marks a class.
There is correct English. That is not slang.
I beg your pardon. Correct English is the slang of prigs who write history and essays, and the strongest slang of all is the slang of poets.
You will say anything, Fred, to gain your point.
Well, tell me whether it is slang or poetry to call an ox a leg platter.
Of course you can call it poetry if you like.
Aha, Miss Rosie, you don't know Homer from slang. I shall invent a new game. I shall write bits of slang and poetry on slips and give them to you to separate. Dear me, how amusing it is to hear young people talk, said Mrs. Vincey with cheerful admiration. Have you got nothing else for my breakfast, Pritchard? Said Fred to the servant who brought in coffee and buttered toast, while he walked round the table surveying the ham, potted beef, and other cold remnants with an air of silent rejection and polite forbearance from signs of disgust.
Should you like eggs, sir?
Eggs, no. Bring me a grilled bone.
Really, Fred, said Rosamond when the servant had left the room, if you must have hot things for breakfast, I wish you would come down earlier. You can get up at 6 o'clock to go out hunting. I cannot understand why you find it so difficult to get up on other mornings.
That is your want of understanding, Rosie. I can get up to go hunting because I like it.
What would you think of me if I came down 2 hours after everyone else and ordered grilled bone?
I should think you were an uncommonly fast young lady, said Fred, eating his toast with the utmost composure.
I cannot see why brothers are to make themselves disagreeable any more than sisters.
I don't make myself disagreeable. It is you who find me so. Disagreeable is a word that describes your feelings and not my actions.
I think it describes the smell of grilled bone.
Not at all. It describes a sensation in your little nose associated with certain finicking notions which are the classics of Mrs. Lemon's school. Look at my mother. You don't see her objecting to everything except what she does herself. She is my notion of a pleasant woman. Bless you both, my dears, and don't quarrel, said Mrs. Vincey with motherly cordiality. Come, Fred, tell us all about the new doctor. How is your uncle pleased with him?
Pretty well, I think. He asks Lydgate all sorts of questions, and then screws up his face while he hears the answers, as if they were pinching his toes. That's his way.
Ah,
Here comes my grilled bone.
But how came you to stay out so late, my dear? You only said you were going to your uncle's.
Oh, I dined at Plimdale's. We had whist. Lydgate was there, too.
And what do you think of him? He is very gentlemanly, I suppose. They say he is of excellent family. His relations quite county people.
Yes, said Fred. There was a Lydgate at John's, who spent no end of money. I find this man is a second cousin of his. But rich men may have very poor devils for second cousins.
It always makes a difference, though, to be of good family, said Rosamond, with a tone of decision which showed that she had thought on this subject.
End of disc 3.